Dan Feldman here. Welcome to the second episode of the Locked On Pistons podcast. We're a new podcast covering the Detroit Pistons for the Locked On Network. If you haven't already, check out our first episode. I rank all the Pistons' off-season moves worst to best. Check it out now. You can close this, come back to this, get a feel for where I stand on the off-season before you keep listening to me. Or you can keep listening to this and listen to it after. You can find us on Audio Boom and iTunes. We'll be on Stitcher soon. We might even be already by the time you listen to this. So thanks for checking us out. Let's get into it. A few topics I want to talk about today. The first is a small little piece of contract minutia that Ray McCallum signed a summer contract. And I saw some people asking what that means. Here's the, in simplest terms, on a summer contract, teams are limited to having to pay a player if he gets hurt $6,000. That's it. On a regular contract, if the player gets hurt, his salary is protected. It's guaranteed until he's healthy. You can't just waive a player, even if his contract is otherwise unguaranteed. So the Pistons get a little protection if McCallum gets hurt. But if he beats Lorenzo Brown for the third point guard job in training camp, McCallum will make the roster. A summer contract, you're not forced to get rid of somebody, and there's more complications to it as far as if it's a summer contract, you don't need to have cap room or an exception available to sign them. But because this is a minimum deal, none of that's a big deal. You can always sign players to minimum contracts, I guess, unless you're up against the hard cap, which the Pistons are not. There's something called the minimum salary exception. It's another exception, just like the mid-level exception or the biannual exception or things you more commonly think of as an exception. And you can just jump over the cap to sign somebody to a minimum contract. You always need an exception to exceed the cap. So the Pistons get a little bit of a risk reduction with McCallum because he's on a summer contract. If anything, this speaks a little bit to what the market was for McCallum because this is obviously unfavorable to him. If he could have gotten a contract from a team that would have given him a non-summer contract, a standard contract, where he'd have more protection if he gets hurt, he probably would have taken that. So this just speaks to the market about him. Maybe the market's right, maybe the market's wrong, and even if the market's right, he still might be better than Lorenzo Brown. I mean, we're talking about competing for a third point guard spot. Moving on. There was a report from an agent, a former agent, writing for CBS Sports, and he worked with Shaquille O'Neal's agent in 1996 when Shaq made his big move from the Magic to the Lakers. And according to this agent, Joel Corey, Corey had to put together a list of teams for Shaq to consider. And on that list of about a handful, you guessed it, the Detroit Pistons. And who knew that the Pistons were ever in the running in 1996 for Shaq? I mean, Shaq was the premier free agent of a generation. Before LeBron, before Durant, before all these big, big-time free agencies, I mean, Shaq was huge, and he was unrestricted. Even though he was coming off, you know, just his first few seasons with the Magic, and Corey really gets into this in this piece, I highly recommend it. The NBA was sort of an in-between period where they'd had restricted free agency for a long time for basically everybody. It was a lot wider. The players fought back. It probably swung too far the other direction. Now we have a medium where if you're a young player, if you're coming off your rookie skill contract, if you were not a first-round pick, but have fewer than 3 years experience, you can be a restricted free agent. Now there's kind of a happy medium where teams can keep you a little bit. But this was this moment in time where Shaq was an unrestricted free agent, very young, obviously a bright Hall of Fame career ahead of him, a ton of NBA success behind him. I mean, he had already proven himself one of the best players in the NBA. And he hits free agency, and on the list of teams that his agency thought he should consider was the Pistons. And according to Corey, the number one thing, and this should be pretty obvious, was Grant Hill. who was the rookie of the year a year before, and had just looked excellent. The problem, among many, was that Allen Houston was also a free agent, and that was another part of the appeal. You know, Allen Houston, a good three-point shooter, would have complimented Hill and Shaq very, very well. He went to the Knicks. Made the Pistons a lot less desirable. I don't think it would have mattered anyway. And according to Corey, the Pistons weren't that interested. Which, I don't know. In hindsight, well, heck yeah, get interested. Do whatever you can to get Shaq. But this is the Pistons' mindset now. It's apparently been the Pistons' mindset for a long time, and maybe not so much under Joe Dumars, but before and after, definitely with Stan Van Gundy, he's pretty open about this. Detroit is not a premier market. The Pistons don't think they're going to get the very highest-end free agents, and so they don't waste time on it. And maybe that's true. Maybe getting Shaq would have been a pipe dream. Maybe they would have wasted time. Maybe they wouldn't have been able to have other moves, although that offseason didn't go great regardless, losing Allen Houston. But I'm a process over results guy, and I think at the time it made some sense, you know, just to say, hey, we don't think this is serious. And here's the main reason why they probably wouldn't. The Pistons had cap space to offer Shaq a lot of money. That's how Shaq determined his list. You know, the Knicks, the Heat, the Hawks, obviously re-signing with the Magic and going to the Lakers, of course, were options. Just because you have the money to get in the door, it seems like this would have been more about leverage. Pistons were probably wise to move on, but it's a fun what if. You know, the year before that, Shaq just beat up the Pistons in the playoffs. The Magic swept the Pistons in the first round. No answer for him. I mean, they had a upfront, close-up look of how dominant Shaq was, and they still passed. Probably because they thought they were being used as leverage. They probably would have been being used as leverage. But like I said, it's a fun what-if. Another what-if. Fun thing that came out recently. Chauncey Billups did a podcast with Adrian Wojnarowski of Yahoo Sports. Highly recommend listening to it. It's a good listen. A lot of it's focused on the Nuggets and Billups' time there and Billups' post-playing future. Things not quite Pistons related, but they did get into a few Pistons things. One part where Billups was talking about his future and potentially front office, which he's always talked about. Now he seems maybe a little more open to coaching, when before it was always front office. Don't want to be a coach. He'd be a great coach, but wasn't as interested in it. He talked a little bit about how when the Nuggets traded him and Melo, they probably made a mistake. Because if you remember, right before that, the Nuggets went to the conference finals. Maybe things could have turned differently. They could have gotten to the finals and played the Magic. Maybe they could have won that. I mean, they were a hop, skip, and a jump away from a championship. And that was sort of Billups' advice to Melo, who drove this whole thing, the trade to the Knicks, and to make the cap numbers work, Billups was also traded to the Knicks. Billups tried to explain to him, if you're close to a championship, don't throw that away. It's hard to get to this point. It's hard to become a championship contender. If you can get here, stay the course. And I think that applies to the trade that sent Billups out from Detroit. The biggest drawback to that trade is it shook up a team that probably was not going to win a title, but might have. I think the odds were against it, but they were in the conversation at that point. This was the tail end of the Billups, Rasheed Wallace, Tayshaun Prince, you know, still around as the core, and Rip Hamilton, and yeah, the team was slipping, and there were major signs of decline, and they had become stagnant, and they probably weren't going to win. But if you get that close to a title, I don't think you break that up. I think you stick with it. And that's not how I thought at the time. I thought shaking things up, getting an Allen Iverson could provide a jolt. That and, you know, some other examples like the Melo trade just sort of taught me a lesson. And it's one Billups seems to know too. And I think that would bode well for his ability to work in a front office, maybe to eventually run a front office. That for the most part, the goal should be becoming a championship contender. And yes, you want to do small things around the margins to increase your chances above other championship contenders. And occasionally a team like the Warriors can go out and jump even ahead of the tier of regular championship contenders. But for the most part, if you become a contender, you just got to roll the dice and hope it works out. Even if your odds are a little less than other contenders, it's so hard to reach that level. The Pistons have been trying to get there since, and they haven't. And they're not really close to it yet. And maybe they can get there in the next couple of years. But they're chasing still where they were when they traded Billups. That said, something else Billups brought up that I had never heard him acknowledge before. Because he's always been respectful of the Pistons, and obviously they've retired his jersey, and there's a good relationship there, and I think he appreciates his time in Detroit, and is not one to publicly express any bitterness about them trading him. That's just not him. You know, he's a high road type of guy. But one thing he acknowledged was that trade woke him up a little bit. And I think a lot of Pistons fans, and there's plenty of fair reasons to consider to criticize the Billups for Iverson trade. But I think a lot of Pistons fans unfairly have criticized it by saying, look how great Billups is in Denver. Why would you trade somebody so good? I don't think he could have been as good in Detroit. I think he had just sort of gotten too comfortable. Motivation is a tricky thing. You can't just say, I'm going to play harder. You need to have something driving you. You need to find that. And I just don't think he had anything to tap into here. I don't think he was going to be the same player had the Pistons kept him. And he didn't quite put it in those terms, but he talked about how this trade woke him up. It changed his mindset going home to Denver and just being in a new environment and, you know, one team saying you're not the right guy anymore. And, you know, there's a lot of things going on. But that change of scenery was very, very good for him. And I thought it was good that he acknowledged that. I think it was very truthful. That's one thing I've always liked about Billups. He seems to be very in tune with everything going on. Not the type of player, Rip Hamilton, who can sort of delude himself into thinking things are one way or another way when reality doesn't match. Another point Billups brought up. In 2005, when the Pistons were in the finals, defending champs, playing against the Spurs, Larry Brown was hemming and hawing about his contract, complaining to ownership, complaining to management, negotiating with the Knicks. A lot of stuff going on. And the Pistons are trying to play in the finals. And this is where I really recommend you listen to Woj's podcast, because I can't do this justice just talking about it. But Chauncey Billups, there was a sadness in his voice. And he talked about, yeah, no, the players weren't really thinking about it because they were focused on what their jobs are. And they were really trying to get into it with, you know, themselves and saying, hey, we're making these mistakes. You know, let's buckle down. I've got to stop committing turnovers. You can't foul here. And they really put it on themselves because that's how players are conditioned. That's what got them to the NBA. If you're a good high school player, a good college player, and you're blaming somebody else for all your shortcomings, you're not going to develop your game to the next level and get to the NBA and thrive in the NBA. It's not a mindset that works. So even when things are somebody else's fault, even when other things are going wrong that are really outside of your control, that's how high-level professional athletes think. They put it on themselves because that's what got them there. That's the mindset that works for them. But in hindsight, and Billups doesn't quite say this directly, but he said the players on that team, and they still talk all the time, they still talk a decent amount about, hey, remember when Larry Brown was negotiating with the Knicks while we were trying to play in the finals? And there was just a sadness in Billups' voice, and I sort of get the sense of, you know, maybe this is another what if. That finals went seven games. It was a weird series. The Spurs won two blowout games at home in 1 and 2. The Pistons won two blowout games in 3 and 4 at home. And then games 5, 6, and 7 were real close, down to the wire, great games. I'm sure you remember how game 5 ended with Rasheed Wallace doubling off Robert Horry and Horry hitting the 3 to win it. But the Pistons buckled down in game 6, won game 6 in San Antonio when the Spurs could have closed it out. Just a real tough-nosed game from Detroit. And then even in game 7, the Pistons had the lead late and looked like they could pull it off, and then the Spurs just sort of went on a run and pulled away and won the title. And so the margin for error in this series was minuscule in games 5, 6, and 7 in the series overall. And you just sort of wonder, was Larry Brown fully engaged? Was he fully prepared to help this team? Did he have his eye on every little piece of strategy, anywhere he could have gotten a competitive advantage? Or was he, you know, I'm sure he was coaching. I don't think that. But was he at all split? Was he at all unfocused? Where, you know, did he spend an hour someday during the finals talking to the Knicks or his agent about the Knicks when he could have been watching more film? Would that have helped? Would watching more film have made a difference, or had he had seen everything he needed to see? You know, there's a limit to it, too. If you're working hard, and this is true of any job, if you're just working harder and harder and harder without any breaks, without anything to keep your mind fresh, that can backfire, too. So we'll never know. But it's something that I think the Pistons on that team, the players, I think they wonder about it. I'm wondering more about it. And to give Larry Brown quote-unquote credit, he'd been through this before. He's a heck of a coach, but he changes jobs all the time. He whines about his contract all the time. You know, I love Larry Brown, but he's a huge, huge hypocrite with all the play the right way. Well, negotiating with the Knicks during the finals, that's not doing things, quote-unquote, the right way. But he does that. That's him. That's who he is. He's used to this. It might have been awkward for the Pistons players to know their coach was negotiating with another team during the finals. That's not the norm for players in the finals to have to go through that. But those types of weird situations are the norm for Larry Brown. And if anybody can handle it and coach through it, it's him. That doesn't mean the players would respond to it well. But if you take Billups at his word, and I do, the players didn't really think about it much during the finals. This seems to be something more that comes up afterward as they look back on it. Another Larry Brown memory, Chauncey Billups brought up, by the way, after the Malice in the Palace, there's all this chaos. Pistons get back to the locker room. Larry Brown is in tears. And he said, "You put a black eye on the game." And by you, he meant the players on both teams. And Billups, you know, there's definitely a little bit of who us? Like, this was the Pacers. They fought the fans. Like, Billups put this mostly on then Ron Artest, Meta World Peace Now, that, hey, you should just fought the dude who wanted to fight you. And that's, of course, Ben Wallace. If you don't remember, I mean, the aftermath took all of the, well, the attention, deservedly so, but if you don't remember how this started, this was a pretty big early regular season game. The Pistons and the Pacers were the class of the Eastern Conference, developing a pretty good rivalry. This was a game people in both fan bases were looking forward to, just sort of as a measuring stick. And the Pistons kicked the Pacers kicked the Pistons' butt. This game was a blowout late in the game. Ben Wallace just hacked Ron Artest. You know, this was a fight-starting foul. It wasn't trying to block a shot. Ben Wallace was frustrated and wanted to send a message that, you know, we could at least do something to you. And Ron Artest wanted nothing to do with it. He went late on the scoreboard and somebody threw a cup on him. And obviously, you know where it goes from there. So to blame the Pistons for where it went from there, I don't know about all that. And obviously, Billups didn't either. Ben Wallace wanted to be involved in a typical basketball fight-shoving match. That's what he wanted. And that's not necessarily a black eye in the game. I'm not the biggest fan of those, but that's not those happen. That's not a black eye on the game. Larry Brown saw it a little differently. Maybe he was just lashing out a little bit in the moment. If one of the iconic scenes from the Malice is when Larry Brown tries to get on the mic to implore everybody to stop. And I don't know if they wouldn't turn the mic on for him or if it wasn't working or what, but he was just screaming at whoever was in charge of the mic because his message wasn't getting out, and he slams the mic down. I mean, it's for all the things Larry Brown does, he cares about the game and he cares about the purity of basketball, and the incident was a black eye on it, and the Pistons players were who were in front of him. But this is Larry Brown. It's a little bit do as I say, not as I do, and just to blame probably the wrong people and to be overly emotional and frustrated and take things personally. And this is who he is. Don't take the things he says personally, though, because he's just trying to coach you. All right, I think that's enough of a blast into the past, although this time of year it's always fun. Want to go into a few lists of the present. CBS Sports did a fun thing about ranking every team by starting lineup and by bench. Pistons have developed into a middle-of-the-road team, maybe a little above that. So I figured, oh, you know, these lists are starting to be fun. A few years ago, it was, all right, well, where in the 20s are they? They're not going to be last. They're not embarrassingly bad. But on all these kinds of lists, they're going to be somewhere in the 20s. Shrug your shoulders and go, okay. So I'm going through this list, expecting to see the Pistons above the 20s. Starting lineup, it's pretty good. Reggie Jackson, Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, Tobias Harris, Marcus Morris, Andre Drummond. That's a solid unit. Number 9. I did not expect the Pistons to be that high. But you look at the list, and it sort of makes sense. I mean, this is a pretty balanced unit. The players fit the coaching style. When you have Marcus Morris and Tobias Harris as your combo forwards, that works. Maybe you wish you had a little more three-point shooting. But there's a good enough amount of spacing around Andre Drummond. There's defensive versatility. You can play a style that works. And, you know, I think number 9, when you look at it, that's a pretty accurate ranking. The teams behind them that maybe you could say are better. The Timberwolves could make a leap with Ricky Rubio, Zach LaVine, Andrew Wiggins, Karl-Anthony Towns. And CBS put Gorgui Dieng at power forward. I sort of think it's going to be Kevin Garnett. But Karl-Anthony Towns is incredible. That team could make a big leap. The Trailblazers with Damian Lillard, CJ McCollum, Al-Farouq Aminu, and Mason Plumlee, that's pretty good. I think Evan Turner is going to be a little bit of a minus for them from where they were last year. Maybe they'll figure it out and put in, you know, Alan Crabb starting as a shooting small forward who can take advantage of the open looks that they can get from Lillard and McCollum, two good passers. maybe that lineup's ahead. With Evan Turner, I'm good with the Pistons ahead. And then number eight is the Grizzlies with Mike Conley, Tony Allen, Chandler Parsons, Zach Randolph, Marc Gasol, which is a really strong lineup. Like, I think there's a little bit of a drop-off to the Pistons. But the fact that the Pistons are right behind a lineup like that, it's encouraging. You know, it's just nice to see the Pistons in that position after, like I said, years and years of being in the blah 20s. And then CBS comes out with the top benches. And this, honestly, I sort of thought the Pistons would rank higher if you didn't have me, you know, look team by team, bench than starter. But it's the other way around. The Pistons are number 13 with their bench. And I think that might be a spot or two too low. Between Stanley Johnson, John Luer, Boban Marjanovic, Aaron Baines, Ish Smith, I don't know there's the most talent. This is a pretty versatile bench. Some guys who can play multiple positions, who complement the starters well. Like, that's more important to figure out how the bench helps the starters and makes the starters better rather than just doing, you know, separate rankings. Obviously, it's fun. It's an off-season project. Go for it. But when you put it together, the package is a little more intriguing. You know, Marjanovic and Aaron Baines can come in and play a little bit more of a skilled big than Andre Drummond, at least as far as with the ball in their hands, free throw shooting especially. If the other team doesn't have as strong a center, John Luer can play center. Pistons are starting a couple combo forwards who can play either position. So then you add Stanley Johnson to that mix, and you can. I wouldn't mind the Pistons having another scoring wing, especially somebody a little bit more perimeter oriented, probably a shooting guard, but that could be a small forward. That's probably their biggest weakness in their bench. One stop ahead of them is the Thunder with Enes Kanter, Cameron Payne, Alex Abrines, Nick Collis, and Kyle Singler. I tend to think the Pistons bench is a little bit better than that. Go up a couple spots. It's the Rockets with Pablo Prigioni, Eric Gordon, Corey Brewer, Michael Beasley, and Nene. It's a pretty big injury risk bench. You know, the Pistons could easily wind up better than them. The Knicks are a few spots higher at number nine with Brandon Jennings, Lance Thomas, Kyle O'Quinn, Billy Hernan Gomez, Justin Holiday. I'm not sure yet what to make of Brandon Jennings. I'm not sure he's better than a fringe starter or, you know, top-end reserve. Lance Thomas has developed into a nice player. Kyle O'Quinn had a real disappointing season last year. Maybe he bounces back. But I'm not looking at that as some excellent bench. That should be clearly ahead of the Pistons. I'd probably put the Pistons higher. The Bulls at number eight are also higher with Taj Gibson, Bobby Portis, Doug McDermott, Jerry Grant, Tony Snell. I'm a big Taj Gibson fan. Doug McDermott has been up and down in his career, and a lot of times that's a euphemism for down. It's a nice way to put it, but he's truly been up and down. We'll see where he levels off. I'm not so sure on him. I like Bobby Portis's talent a lot, but he's pretty raw. I still think he might be another year away. They also have Cristiano Felicio, who came on strong last year. Get a sense to see him a little more in the Olympics. I probably would put the Pistons bench ahead of the Bulls, but that's sort of the same tier. And so I do think the Pistons bench could jump up a couple spots. But as it stands, here's every team whose starters and bench both is ranked higher than the Pistons. Warriors, Cavs, Jazz, Spurs, Raptors, Celtics. And that's it. That's the entire list. What I think says a lot about the Pistons' depth, their strength at the top, you know, in Andre Drummond, and all the way down, The Pistons are going to be pretty good this year, I think. And now that doesn't mean they're going to be the seventh best team in the league, because only six teams have better starters and benches. The Clippers have the number three starting lineup and the number 17 bench. Starting lineup obviously matters more. The Clippers are much more top heavy. The Trailblazers on these rankings are two spots lower by starters, but six higher in the bench. They're probably in the same type of tier as the Pistons. Ditto the Trailblazers, who are number eight in starting lineups and number 21 in bench. But the Pistons are going to be, you know, a pretty good team this year. I think these rankings, and you set them out, you get a chance to look at everything at once. I think that's a pretty good indicator of where things stand. I think CBS did a pretty good job with those. I recommend checking them out. All right, one more list for the road. Sports Illustrated ranked every NBA coach by which should be president. And when I clicked on this link, it was from a tweet that said, spoiler, Greg Popovich wasn't number one. Said, all right, it probably should be Popovich, but now I'm curious who they have, how they rank these. And I'm scrolling down, getting into the top 10, 8, 7, 6, and it hits me. I haven't seen Stan Van Gundy yet. Did I miss him? Just keep scrolling down. There he is, number one. What NBA coach would you want as president? That's the choice. Stan Van Gundy, number one. I could get behind that. And I think a lot of voters could, too. I think there's a pretty good support for building a wall. Stan Van Gundy's all about forming a wall. Not sure if I'd vote for him for that, but if watching the West Wing the most times qualifies you for president, Stan Van Gundy probably should be number one as an NBA coach, and I think I'd be pretty far in the running for vice president. All right, that'll do it for our second episode of Locked On Pistons. Thanks, everyone, for listening. If you found yourself listening for this not in your ideal way of listening to a podcast, finding a podcast, you can find us on Audio Boom, iTunes. We'll be on Stitcher soon if we're not already. If you'd like us to look into another way of getting this podcast out there, or you want to talk to me about anything else, you can email me at lockedonpistons@gmail.com. You can also tweet me at Dan Feldman, NBA. Leave a rating for us on iTunes. We'd always appreciate it. And I think we're a couple episodes away from doing user-submitted questions. So if you want to get any of those in, hit me up on email or Twitter, and we'll start to answer those. Thanks, everyone.
Napa Know How. It takes a lot to get excited about a bag, but most bags can't save you 20% on auto parts. That's 20% off headlamps, 20% off oil filters, 20% off virtually anything you can fit inside the 99-cent Napa reusable bag. So tell your buddies, there's a bag they just have to check out. Quality parts, helpful people. That's Napa know-how. Napa know-how. At participating Napa Auto Parts stores while supplies last. Minimum three items. Exclusions apply. Offer ends 10/31/17.